Comrades, I'm honoured to have been asked to deliver this Eurocommunist Memorial Lecture on a topic which is very much relevant to the need for communists, for the workers' movement more generally, to begin to develop effective international collaboration. I should say at the outset that I am not a specialist in the contemporary economics or sociology of migrant labour, so you won't get from me figures for the extent of labour migration, or descriptions of the experiences of migrant workers, or their relations to the cultures and politics, either of their countries of origin or of the countries in which they work. The title, Freedom of Movement of Capital and Restrictions on the Movement of Labour Under Globalisation of the World Economy, describes a pair of linked juridical phenomena. On the one hand, the increased legal freedom of movement of capital created by financial market liberalisation and the widespread abandonment of exchange controls and similar procedures, and on the other, the increasing tightening of forms of legal controls on the movement, international movement of workers, particularly in English terms, immigration law. But though I'm a lawyer, I'm not a specialist in the law of financial markets and monetary flows, nor am I a specialist in immigration law, let alone the comparative study of immigration laws generally. You will therefore not get from me details or analysis of the juridical character of these laws. What I am is a historian of law, a writer to some extent on Marxist theory, and a communist activist. I will approach the problem in the first place as a historical problem, in the second as a problem of Marxist theory, and thirdly as a strategic problem for the workers' movement. The historical problem is identified by the lecture title as having two sides: freedom of movement of capital, controls on the movement of workers. But in fact, each of these problems has more than one aspect. Capital, by its nature, is both free to move and not free to move. And this freedom and unfreedom of capital, which is a contradiction within capital as a social form, also finds expression as a contradiction between particular capitals. I will return to this question in addressing the theoretical problem. The question of migrant labour is three-sided. To put these three sides in a conventional but entirely arbitrary order, they are: first, that there is very substantial actual migration of labour. To give two very different examples, about 500,000 Eastern Europeans have migrated to the UK since 2004, adding slightly less than 1% to the UK population. In Saudi Arabia, there are currently estimated to be around 5 million migrant workers resident, as opposed to, or compared to, a, quote, native population of around 12 million, an extraordinary proportionality. Second, immigration is, at least in the imperialist countries, a political hot-button issue which is routinely exploited by parties of the right and far right. Now, one might imagine that, quote, nativist politics would have no purchase in countries like the United States or Australia, whose population is almost entirely composed of relatively recent generations of immigrants. But this is far from being the case. Each generation of settlers thinks itself as native in relation to the next. If anything, racist discourses about migration are both more endemic and more violent in the US and Australia than they are in European countries. Third, there has been an unevenly progressing increase in border controls, controls on movement, and controls on migrants obtaining citizenship or the legal right to remain in the destination country. A partial exception is provided by the development of the European Union, and in particular by its expansion eastwards after the fall of the Soviet regime and its Eastern European satellite. It is a partial exception because the expansion has made the EU no longer simply a coalition of imperialist countries, but an entity which includes both imperialist countries and countries which are in transition to semi-colonial status. On the other hand, with legal freedom of movement of labour within the EU, has come an increasing attempt via the 1985 Schengen Agreement to tighten controls on entry into the EU from the outside. I said that the conventional order in which I presented these three sides is arbitrary. This is an important point. The conventional order contains within itself an implied causal narrative. There is a lot of migration. Therefore, as it were naturally, there is a nativist reaction. Then governments appease this nativist reaction by introducing immigration controls. But the narrative could perfectly well, and equally plausibly, be presented differently. There are legal controls on migrant labour. The existence of these legal controls facilitates intensified exploitation of migrant workers. Therefore, capitalists seek migrant workers in order to obtain higher profits, and this in turn leads to higher migration, which in turn leads to reduces average wages, leading to a nativist reaction. Or it could be the parties at the right, for some reason unconnected with actual migration, promote nativist ideology. Hence, we get legal controls on immigration. Hence, increasing exploitation is possible, leading capitalists to seek to import migrant labour, leading to increased migration. In reality, in other words, what is involved is three aspects of a single totality, and any attempt to disentangle fully the causal relations between these three elements produces a snake eating its own tail. Why do I describe this as a historical problem? The answer is that it is widely believed, as indeed implicit in the title which Comrades gave me, Freedom of Movement of Capital and Restricted to Movement of Labour Under Globalisation, that this is a new phenomenon. Maybe it's to be new in the sense of being part of Ernest Mandel's late capitalism, identified then starting with the Black Commonwealth immigration into Britain from the 1950s, and at the same period the analogous North African migration to France, and German exploitation of Gastarbeiter. Or maybe it's to be new in the strongest sense of being an aspect of US-led world capital's turn to financial globalization after the crisis in the 1970s. The historical evidence suggests, however, that this is not the case. The promotion of freedom of movement of capital and of unfreedom of movement of labor, together with actual migration and the political tensions associated with it, go back to the beginning of modern capitalist politics in England with the English revolutions of the 17th century. Grasping the phenomenon theoretically will therefore require grasping it as an aspect of the inner logic of capital in general, not as a peculiar feature of the particular forms of late 20th and 21st century capitalism. The mobile and ruthless character of capital was already identified as a political problem in the party political rhetoric of the reign of Queen Anne, 1702 to 1714, which contrasted the, quote, landed interest and the, quote, moneyed interest. This rhetoric had some antecedents in later medieval nativist rhetoric against Jews and foreign merchants. But this specific contrast of land and money as forms of wealth and mobility and immobility, produced with the idea that mobile capital has lower stake in the nation state and behaves in an internationalist fashion against the interests of the nation state, was new. It reflects the emergence of the London financial markets in the 1690s and their integration at the time, strong integration, with the financial markets of Amsterdam. Political rhetoric of this type had significant influence and continued to be used mainly by Tories episodically into the period of the 19th century debates leading to the Reform Act. It has mutated in modern times. People talk about city short-termism in America, about the dominance of Wall Street, about financial capital versus productive capital, and so on and so forth. As I have just said, nationalist or nativist rhetoric against Jews and foreign merchants and against the employment of foreigners by kings in the state goes back to the Middle Ages. I should say, incidentally, that to say this is pretty unorthodox Marxism, since the orthodox view, reaffirmed in postmodern form in Benedict Anderson's Imagined Communities, is that nationalism as such is a modern capitalist phenomenon. However, to claim that nationalism is modern involves leaving wholly without a theoretical home phenomena such as the English barons nolimus leges Angliae mutari, we do not wish the laws of England to be changed, in 1236, the agitation at the same time against King Henry III's Poitevin French advisers, any number of university riots between the nationes into which the various continental universities were organised, English, French, Germans, Italians, and so on, and urban riots in this country against Lombards and Hanse merchants, which continued episodically down to the 1520s. These are phenomena of a feudal society and express its internal class contradictions. They have a late flowering in the Catholic clerisy's promotion of anti-Semitism as a last defence against the rise of capitalism in late 19th and early 20th century Europe. In 1680s England, however, we find the first instance of a new form of nativist rhetoric, directed by Tories against Huguenot, French Protestant refugees settling in England. The new rhetoric blamed the Huguenots for taking English jobs and for not assimilating to the Church of England. The Tory party and its literary and artistic hangers-on were to play this card over and over again between then and now. A Tory campaign in the 1750s against proposals to facilitate naturalisation, the acquisition of citizenship by immigrants, mixed the new rhetoric with the old by focusing on the possibility that Jews might be able to be naturalised. In the 1790s, French emigres, as well as feared French subversive republicans, were targeted by the First Aliens Act, 1796. In the 1800s, the focus was on Irish migrant labour, in a campaign of defamation which gave us the word hooligan. From the beginning of the 20th century up to World War II, the focus was again on Jews. But though conventional Catholic Jewish capitalist rhetoric can be found among the ideological products, the campaigning edge behind the Aliens Act 1905 was East European Jews moving into London, taking British jobs and refusing to assimilate. From the 1950s, this rhetoric moved on to niggers, and in the 1970s, on to packies. The war on terror has its own peculiar logic of victimisation, but we seem today to be at a moment at which the core of nativist anti-immigrant rhetoric is shifting onto Eastern Europeans. American history, of course, lacks classic Toryism. Tories as such were driven out in the American Revolution. But the history of waves of migration into the United States is also a history of nativist rhetoric against migrants. From Irish immigrants and the nativist know-nothings of the 1840s and 50s to today's US efforts to reinforce its Mexican border against Latino migration. And the earlier instances of the use of new-style nativist rhetoric about jobs and assimilation targeted relatively small numbers of migrants at a period in which the proletariat as a class was in process of formation. Leibold Redeker's many-headed hydra illustrates the extent to which one of the central elements in the formation of the new class, seafarers and port workers, was from the outset migrant and international in its composition. The rhetoric thus relates in an oblique way to a real phenomenon of labour mobility which could be found from the beginning of capitalism. Other examples of large-scale migration can also be found from the high period of imperialism. For example, in the importation of Indian labour into South and East Africa and Malaya, and of Chinese labour into the Western United States. It's familiar to historians, so familiar as to be often ignored, but probably less familiar to Marxists, that throughout the period of the rise of industrial capitalism in England, the state maintained legal controls on the internal movement of workers within the country. Under the Poor Law, parishes, the basic unit of the Anglican Church, and also to some extent of secular governments, were obliged to provide relief to the poor, principally the unemployed. Under the Settlement Act 1662 and following acts, unemployed workers could be deported to their parish of origin. The acts gave rise, were substantially used, and gave rise to a formidably large body of law, which has not yet wholly been untangled. There are just so many reported cases on settlement. And were not formally abolished until 1948, though they weren't much used in practice after the later 19th century. Under the Poor Law regime, moreover, the children of the unemployed, or poor children, could be compulsorily apprenticed to an employer, which made it illegal for them to leave that employer for the 7 years duration of the apprenticeship. The early mill owners extensively bought apprentices from parishes to bring in to staff their new mills in the Pennines. But over this period, if there were efforts to control the mobility of labour, capital's mobility increased. Witness the fairly stunning growth of the financial markets over the 18th century. Witness also the textile mills in the valleys of the Pennines and a variety of other manufacturing establishments created outside corporate boroughs in order to escape the legal regulatory powers of those boroughs. This history points to a simple conclusion, which I suggested before. The complex phenomenon of increasingly free movement of capital, legal constraints on the movement of labour, actual large-scale employment of migrant labour despite these legal constraints, and nativist rhetoric against migrant workers is nothing new. It is an endemic feature of capitalism, more or less visible from one time, place, or economic sector to another, to be sure, but nonetheless a body of dynamics of capitalism as such, not of imperialism, the highest stage, nor of late capitalism, nor indeed of globalism. To recognise a general dynamic of capitalism as such towards freedom of movement of capital and attempts to control movement of labour poses a theoretical problem for Marxists, or more exactly, a group of theoretical problems. The underlying problem is that the way Marx's Capital is written is to postulate a pure capitalist economy in which there is neither unfreedom of movement of capital nor unfreedom of movement of labour. To a considerable extent, moreover, Marx explains the nation-state in these terms. In this explanation, in order to create a capitalist market, a national market which will function to enable capitalism, the capitalists are driven to expand beyond the horizons of the city and borough and create a nation state. But the idea of a national market itself involves freedom of movement of labour as well as of capital. Because without freedom of movement of labour, there is no national market, but rather a series of local markets, both in labour power and in the basic goods consumed by labour. To the extent that Marx's theories of the emergence of capitalism have been developed, they've tended to be accounts of the emergence of freedom of movement of both capital and labour within the emergent nation state through the overcoming of forms of personal servitude and of the regulatory powers of the boroughs, guilds, and monopoly corporations. So this sort of explanation of the nation state in terms of the development of the national market will not enable us to derive the historical phenomena that I was just talking about. More fundamentally, Jareth Banerjee, in a 2003 article in Historical Materialism, has argued that the sharp differentiation between free and unfree labour made by many Marxists is unsound and internalises the liberal ideology of freedom of contract. Rather, he argues, there is a spectrum of capitalist relations to labour which runs from one extreme. At one extreme, the characterization of the slave plantations of the American South as capitalist enterprises through various intermediate forms to, at the other extreme, the conventionally free worker who is bound to capital as such, but not to any individual capitalist. Our 18th century apprentices bound for 7 years and workers deportable if they become employed fall as intermediate points on this spectrum. The difficulty Banerjee poses, though he doesn't express it in his 2003 article, is that the precise distinguishing feature of Marx and Engels' strategical conception of the way to get beyond capitalism rests on the difference between free labourer, serf and slave. Marx and Engels argue that because the proletariat is freed from the means of production, neither owned like a slave of the means of production, nor owned with the land like a serf and tied to the land, the proletariat can, by emancipating itself, emancipate the whole of society. Banerjee's spectrum of unfreedom calls this argument into serious question. If it was really possible to have a capitalism which as a whole and effectively denied freedom of movement to labour, we would be forced to abandon the whole idea that the proletariat as a class was freed from the means of production, and hence could, by emancipating itself, emancipate the whole of society. We might still find Marx's economics useful in the analysis of capitalist dynamics. But frankly, since capital, as I said before, actually presupposes the free labourer, the whole analysis of Marx's Capital presupposes the free movement of labour, such a use would probably be of extremely limited value. We would certainly have to abandon any idea of connection between the workers' movement and the general emancipation of humanity in favour of some form of utopian or ethical socialism. Banerjee is perfectly well aware that in fact we cannot have capitalism with universal unfreedom of labour. In his 2003 article he cites for this point one of his own previous articles from 1977. But it's almost a throwaway point. And in his Agrarian Change in Late Antiquity in 2001, Banerjee's methodology of this spectrum of free-unfree wage relations leads him to find proto-capitalism in late Roman and Byzantine Egypt and to make extensive analytical use of economic categories which are in substance neoclassical. By destroying the Marxist categorization of free and unfree labour in consequence, in other words, Banerjee is forced back on the classical bourgeois economics, and in doing so, like other neoclassical institutionalist economists studying aspects of the past, he projects back capitalist categories onto the pre-capitalist world. The logic of capital becomes a timeless truth. The key to escaping this problem, in my view, is a group of understandings. First, we have to grasp Marx's Capital in terms of an abstraction from the real development of capitalism, or to put the same point in another way, a counterfactual analysis of what the consequences would be if the pure capitalism recommended by the political economists was actually created. Second, the project of which Capital 1 and Engels' reconstructions of Capital 2 and 3 are part is very radically unfinished, as Harvey and more recently Leibowitz have argued. I would add, as I've argued elsewhere, that this is true in particular because the form of the state cannot be derived, the national form of the state cannot be derived directly from the laws of movement of capital and commodity production. It's rather an inheritance from feudalism. Third, the laws of motion which the text discusses are laws which are instantiated in the real world as probabilistic laws of tendency, not as exact laws. Several authors, again, Harvey most notably, but also Carcetti, have argued this point. An associated point of this last is that made by de Saint-Croix in discussing classical antiquity. A mode of production or class order as applied to a society refers to the dominant mode by which surplus is extracted, not to the only mode by which production relations are organized. It does not imply that all other forms of organizing production are absent. In particular, petty proprietorship and petty family production are present in classical antique slave society as well as in feudalism, and continue to be present on a large scale in capitalism. Turning to our present concerns, capital tends to aspire to freedom of movement for capital, but does not fully achieve it. And it tends to produce both freedom of movement of labour and unfreedom of movement of labour, or at least aspirations to control the movement of labour. What is involved is a group of contradictions for capital as inescapable as the contradiction between the capitalist's need as employer to pay the workers less and his need as a seller of commodities that the workers should buy more commodities. What follows is necessarily tentative, both because what I've just said points towards my account being about tendencies, not about absolute predictions, but also because it is a hypothesis or sketch, not a fully developed account. It's appropriate to begin with freedom of movement of capital. As I said before, capital is both mobile and immobile. This reflects the underlying, elementary Marxist point that capital is not a fixed thing, but a process. From money to commodity, C, to C-dash, change commodity, to increased money, M-dash. As M or M-dash, capital is highly mobile and rootless. No state has actually succeeded in making money immobile without turning it into pseudo-money like the old Soviet ruble. Even at the high period of Bretton Woods and exchange controls, there were a variety of devices which allowed big money capital to move between countries. But in transition from C to C-dash in the process of production, or before the passage from C-dash to M-dash is completed, capital is embodied in and tied down to things and persons, as such it is vulnerable to local events. This is true even of shipping, seemingly classically mobile. Ships and their crews are subject to shipwreck, to piracy, and to arrest in port. It may appear in our financialized world that money can be made out of nothing but money, and it's certainly the case that the financial markets and their liquidity provide a buffer for capitalists against the risks of material investment. But at the end of the day, no one can eat, wear, live in, drive, etc., money. It's elementary Marxism that there has to be material productive activities going on to produce the social surplus that money represents and is able to buy. And these material productive activities are also capital, and the extent to which they are mobile is highly variable. Recent developments have indeed increased the mobility of material productive activities. It's important to recognise how this wizard weave has been pulled off. There are two elements. The first is very substantial state subsidies to transport in the form of direct subsidies to rail and road networks, tax breaks like aviation fuel, and the artificial legal limitation of liability, which has enabled ship owners in particular to externalise substantial parts of their costs onto shippers, consignees and seafarers. The second is simple and direct subsidies and tax breaks to new business starts and foreign direct investment. These are large enough to make it profitable, for example, to build a new car plant somewhere in Britain run it for 5 years while the New Start subsidies are still running, and then close it down and start up elsewhere on the basis of new subsidies. Even so, this sort of operation is only feasible for the largest corporations who are already operating on a world scale before the shell game of New Start subsidies reached the imperialist centres. Small and medium-sized enterprises are much more immobile, among other reasons because their goodwill may well be much more local. This is true a fortiori of the petty proprietors, proper, those who own means of production sufficient to work themselves or to demand a rent from capital, but not enough to allow them to exploit labour. For the peasant farmer to leave his land, the shopkeeper his shop, or the lawyer the jurisdiction in which he has corporate monopoly knowledge, is to abandon most of his assets. Infrastructural enterprises like the Channel Tunnel or Network Rail are effectively completely immobile. The old official communist strategy of an anti-monopoly alliance, or alliance with national capital against imperialism, was built around this contradiction. The trouble is that though this appears in political form as a contradiction between particular capitals, or between big capital and the petty proprietors, it is actually a contradiction within capital as a process. The biggest corporation may get caught short holding material assets when they devalorize. The smallest shopkeeper may be willing to sell up at a severe loss and get out of the country when facing a threat that the working class will take over or the state collapse into warlordism and his fixed property loses value entirely. The contradiction nevertheless does produce mundane capitalist politics. The rhetorical opposition of the landed interest to the moneyed interest in British politics around 1700 is precisely an example. A group of politicians put together a coalition of landowners, a species of capitalist employer, and I insist, incidentally, that British landowners, English landowners around 1700 were capitalist employers, heavily committed to fixed and immobile capital, with a section of the petty proprietors. Similar coalitions are behind a great deal of nativist and anti-immigrant political rhetoric. If we turn now to the mobility of labour, we should start by saying that it is not true that a national market, and hence mobility of labour within the nation, is a presupposition of the capital relation, i.e. something which the capital relation has to have in place in order for it to exist. The capital relation, once it comes into existence, tends to create expanding market relations. I carefully do not say a national market, since it is reasonably clear that capitalism begins in the interstices of feudalism with an expanding set of international market relations, in particular in the textile industry, centred on northern and central Italy. And in addition, since both Amsterdam and London as international centres are from the outset international market centres and the centres of states which contend for global military political power. On the other hand, differentiated local markets, affected by specific conditions, persist in even the most developed capitalist countries. There is not, therefore, a necessity for a uniform market, and therefore for freedom of movement of labour. It is, on the other hand, a presupposition of the capital relation that there should be somewhere in the system within which capital operates some free labour, that is, some labour which is freely available to capital. This means labour which is not, in the first place, owned outright by the members of some other ruling class, in which case the capitalists would have to pay rent which involved a profit share with those people. Secondly, cannot simply be forcibly enslaved. And thirdly, has been freed from the peasants' and artisans' property rights. As capital expands, its demand for labour increases, and this puts pressure on the existing feudal unfreedoms of the peasants and artisans. This process Marx described as a limit to the dialectical mode of presentation, that is, that it's a historical process which cannot be simply derived out of the logic of capital in itself, but has to be explained in terms of the interaction of capital with the feudalism which precedes it. Once this process is substantially complete, as was certainly the case in England by the late 17th to early 18th century, and probably earlier, the mobility of labour becomes a contradiction to capital. On the one hand, it is in the interest of every particular capital as an employer to restrict the mobility of labour and its unfreedom relative to the particular employer, because restrictions on the mobility of labour can improve the employer's bargaining position in the wage relation. This is true, after all, to your eyes, to the extent that capital itself is mobile. To the extent that capital is mobile, the fact that you create dependency of labour on capital through, for example, truck or debt bondage systems, doesn't create the danger of dependency of capital on labour because of the fact that capital has lent out large sums of money to these people. It's possible to cash up and go away. To the extent that capital is immobile, there is more of a problem of this sort. On the other hand, it is also in the interest of every capitalist employer that the pool of labour available to the employer, or in other words, the number of workers competing for its jobs, should be maximised, since this also reduces the workers' local bargaining power. And this interest will quite commonly involve an interest in the mobility of labour. We should expect that, like the contradiction between the mobility of capital and its immobility, which I discussed above, the result of this contradiction should appear in contradictions between capitals and more distantly in political contradictions. And so it does. Both the poor law and modern attempts to control labour migration have been the subject of political contradictions in which different branches of capital have been ranged on opposing sides. Moreover, there are particular variations. Mining operations, for example, involve a high proportion of fixed capital assets and therefore capital immobility, often in areas of low population density and dangerous and unpleasant labour. In this context, capitalists have sought both to force labour mobility to bring workers to the job, and once they've got them there, to force labour immobility to keep them there. In relation to the mobility of capital, it's been possible to treat the petty proprietors simply as very small capitalists. In relation to the mobility of labour, this is no longer possible. The basic reason is that the petty proprietors actually depend on the exploitation of family labour. The shopkeeper gets wives and children to help in the shop. The family farmer makes them work on the farm. The self-employed artisan, or the professional or managerial owner of Guild Monopoly intellectual property, is free to work longer hours than any but ultra-exploited workers, develop a small surplus out of this overworking himself by the intensified domestic labour of his wife and, in some cases, his children. The labour market, and in particular the mobility of labour, threatens to take away the petty proprietor's control of this domestic labour force. In addition, the reserve army of labour cannot simply be allowed to starve, otherwise it would cease to exist as a reserve army. I leave aside here countries with a subsisting mass peasantry, in which case we may be indeed allowed the unemployed to starve because the labour force can always be replenished from the peasantry. Hence, there have to be tax-supported poor laws and similar arrangements. But the greater mobility of large capital and of capital in money form allows large capital to pass off at least a proportion of its tax cost onto the petty proprietors. Both these aspects drive the political expression of interest in the control of the movement of labour. From the poor law to immigration controls, the primary basis of political support is among the petty proprietors rather than among big capitalist enterprises. If, however, we look at the matter from the side of the worker under capitalism, it should be obvious that the worker as such under capitalism has a clear interest in freedom to move in order to follow the available jobs. Workers move in order to satisfy needs. This is not to say that every worker wants to live a nomadic life of following capital as it moves around. If anything, the contrary is the case. It is merely to say that the mobility of capitalism and the instability of firms and hence jobs in rising and falling markets makes workers need to be able to move if necessary. Given this interest, however, however much capital may seek to control the movement of labour by legal means, it cannot actually achieve effective controls on the actual movement. This is because the very conditions which allow the mobility of capital, spread of market relations, the mobility of money as money, the improvement of transport and so on, also allow in practice the either legal or illegal movement of workers. And bureaucratic regimes achieve control on the actual movement of workers as they did on the actual movement of money. But the price of doing so was substantial encirclement of the whole workforce, leading in turn to interdependency of the managers of particular enterprises as feudalists, in effect, on their particular workers and of the workers on their particular managers, which in turn, unsurprisingly, Soviet feudalism proved to be their ambition in capitalism. What therefore capital achieves by its effort to control the movement of workers is not actual control of this movement, it is rather to create a category of illegal undocumented workers. This group of workers is subject to intensified exploitation, which can, as in the case of trafficked sex workers and some people working for gangmasters, amount to de facto chattel slavery. I said earlier that this is a tentative and hypothetical sketch. But it's enough to enable us to see, on the one hand, that the current global dynamic of freedom of movement of capital and attempts to control the movement as labour can be grounded solidly in basic elements of the logic of the Marxist critique of political economy. Hence, the fact that this dynamic is not new but endemic to capitalism on the historical evidence is explicable. Moreover, the last point, capitalists attempt to control the movement of labour, but succeed only in producing more or less large groups of illegal workers, is critical. It provides a fundamental reason to reject the idea that Banerjee's spectrum of unfree labour could be generalised, because the capitalists simply, insofar as they attempt this, fail to achieve it. Their own economic dynamics work against perfecting the unfreedom of labour. These theoretical questions have significant material strategical implications. There are three aspects to these implications, the first of which is the question of nationalism and internationalism, the second in relation to the question of legality, and the third in relation to the question of class alliances. Most important, I think, is the question of nationalism and internationalism, and I will therefore tackle this first and try not to, if I find that I'm running short of time, I may well not cover the other two issues. The strategy of the second, third, and fourth, and Trotskyist fourth internationals was built around the construction of workers' parties and the working class taking political power in single countries successively. This, in turn, was justified by the idea that uneven development between countries and in capitalism implied that the proletarian class consciousness would also necessarily develop unevenly between nations. The whole strategic approach and the theoretical argument for uneven development between nations in the sense of uneven development of class consciousness was founded on the idea of a necessary homology between capitalism and the nation-state. That is, British capitalism, German capitalism, Turkish capitalism, and so on and so forth. But in order to grasp the economic and political dynamics of capital mobility and labour mobility as phenomena endemic to capitalism, as I've just been trying to do, it's necessary to abandon the idea of a necessary homology between capitalism and the nation-state. Capitalism develops simultaneously as a local, regional, national, continental and global order from the outset. Along with it, the proletariat develops as a local, regional, national and international class. From the beginning, a class which is neither locally nor nationally homogenous, but composed of workers who have migrated from varying distances. I worked for a couple of years in my youth in the county car plant. The workforce there, the plant had been set up in the 1930s, 1940s, and the workforce was therefore entirely composed of first-generation migrants from somewhere else. The somewhere else was quite varied, but there was hardly less difference between the migrants from Ireland, those from London, those from Birmingham, and those from the rural southwest of England than there was between the Brits as a whole and the West Indians. That lack of homogeneity was a real fact about the affecting the class movement, and it is today a real fact affecting any attempt to construct a class movement anywhere. Because of this unhomogeneous character of the proletariat as a class, its character as in fact a class of migrants, in order to conceive itself as a class for itself, as a class with interests independent of the petty proprietors of the capitalists, the proletariat has to begin to conceive itself as an international class. It is not just that there is no socialism in a single country, or, as it seems to me, by virtue of the mobility of capital, the international division of labour, that there is no dictatorship of the proletariat in a single country. It is that there is no class consciousness, no genuine class consciousness in a single country. It is for this reason that the First International, begun by British trade unionists and a variety of emigres in London, in practice had the effect of triggering the development of national independent class movements all over Europe. It's for this reason that the widely known existence of the Second International promoted the development both of mass socialist parties in a large number of countries, but also of class struggles in which the proletariat on a very large scale sought power, even if it didn't achieve power, in the early 20th century. In spite of the fact that the Socialist International as such, in reality, was no more than a postbox, in the sense that the International Socialist Bureau was no more than a postbox for the national parties. The existence of the Socialist International as such, the idea of the Socialist International, enabled a development of class, radical development of class consciousness. It's for this reason that the Comintern and the international communist movement, in spite of the deformations of official communism and so on and so forth, became the frame of class politics as such in most of the countries outside of Europe. In other words, the national strategies for power of the Second, the Third, and the Trotskyist Fourth International, their idea that the working class was to attain class consciousness country by country, was to take political power country by country, even if this country by country process was to be very close together in time, as in Trotsky's theory of world revolution, was not a theory of the coordinated international action of the working class, but of one revolution triggering another revolution, triggering another revolution. These national strategies for power had the effect of actually undermining the basis of the existence of the internationals and of undermining the class consciousness of the proletariat. Today, it's more than ever obvious that a strategy for working class power, or even for serious reforms in a single country, is hopeless. The attempt at such a strategy on the largest possible scale, both in the USSR, quote, socialism in a single country, and in the West, social democratic and New Deal reforms, have failed ignominiously. Capital retains the state power and retains its ability to move between countries, and its retention of the state power and of its ability to move between countries prevents the interests of the proletariat being achieved or even significantly advanced at any level more than the most basic defensive actions and defensive reforms in any single country. For the proletariat to take political power would have to be at least an act on a continental scale, and it would have to involve the combined action of workers from both imperialist countries and colonial countries. At the same time, after a period between the 1900s and the 1970s in which the mobility of labour was submerged, not necessarily in fact, but in the perceptions of the movement, in a dominant language of national politics and national movements, it has become increasingly obvious that the class composition of the proletariat in every single country is mixed between natives and migrants. The idea that it's possible to attain effective class unity, even at the local level, on the basis of striving for a nationally homogenous workers' movement, is exposed as a disastrous illusion. The workers' movement as such now urgently needs practical international collaboration under capitalism in order to conduct elementary struggles over wages and conditions, as well as for reforms. Communists who seek the class power of the working class in the society as a whole urgently need an international. But such an international cannot be an international like the Second or the Third, an international of nations. Because the national proletariats themselves are already mixed international in character. It would have to be an international with organized parts, organize all the workers in the places where they are, whatever their nationality of origin. To actually achieve quite elementary class unity, in other words, we have to take seriously the old tag that the workers have no fatherland. I will speak very briefly on my two other points in relation to legality and class alliances. The question of legality is posed by the fact that capitalist controls on labour movement, on the movement of labour, imply, as I said before, the creation of large groups of illegal workers, quote marks. The practical consequence is it is decreasingly possible for the working class to construct its own unity and conduct again the elementary day-to-day struggle of the trade unions, struggle against landlords, struggle against the state and local authorities, without willingness to break the law and to organise the illegals. I'm not urging here some sort of Maoist or Guevarist strategy of military confrontation with capital in the developed capitalist countries. That would obviously be nonsense, tried, failed, stupid. But it is necessary to recover the tactics and methods of illegal trade union and political organisation from the time before the trade unions were legalised, and to be willing to try to organise among the illegals. This in turn means that it's necessary to have a political party which devotes significant effort to undermining the political authority, the legitimacy of the judiciary and the constitutional order, in order to back up, to promote political solidarity between the legals and the illegals. This is the exact reverse of the course followed by the Eurocommunists, who, in their efforts to avoid appearing to be simply an extension of their regimes in the East, became the most slavish promoters of the ideologies of the rule of law and parliamentary democracy. It's equally, however, the opposite of the efforts of the movementists and the Trotskyists to try and avoid constitutional issues altogether and say what we need is just to promote the struggle. But in order to promote the struggle, it is necessary to confront the problem of legality and the problem of illegality. The problem of class alliances is posed by what I've discussed about the conflict between the interests of the petty proprietors in controlling labour mobility and the interests of the workers in relation to mobility of labour and in relation to class unity. Since the time of Lenin's formula, the democratic dictatorship of the proletariat and peasantry, it's been orthodox Marxism and Leninism to attempt to create a strategy to win the petty proprietors as a whole to the side of the proletariat. This was as true of the early Comintern as it was of the Comintern and the communist movement after the thesis of the People's Front. It was always the case that there was an attempt to win the whole of the petty proprietors. It was a departure from the arguments that Engels had produced in the 1880s and 1890s and Kautsky in the 1890s and 1900s. These authors had argued that there was sufficient antagonism between the interests of the proletariat and the petty proprietors, peasants, artisans, and so on, that the strategy of the proletariat had to be not to win the petty proprietors as a whole, but to split or neutralise the petty proprietors. And that even tactics to split or neutralise the petty proprietors had to be subordinate to the interests of the proletariat in its own unity. That is, that the proletariat has to be willing to organise workers in small businesses. In modern terms, equally, that the proletariat has to have unequivocal commitments to the rights of women and the rights of youth, as against the interests of the petty proprietors in the exploitation of the continued exploitation of family labour, and therefore the continuance of the rules controlling wives and children, the authority of the father on wives and children. The logic of what I have said is that on this front, we probably need to return to the approach of Engels and Kautsky, rather than to imagine that it is possible for the working class to pursue its own interests, while at the same time endeavouring to win the petty proprietors as a whole to the side of the working class. That, I think, is all I have to say.